The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. All is well.
All right. Well, now that the Toronto Raptors have won the NBA championship, I think we can all relax.
There you go.
What the heck? Didn't see it coming.
Yeah, well, you don't expect two catastrophic injuries to one team, so that's what happened. But what the heck? All good for the Raptors. They were there at the right place in the right time, fighting every step of the way, and they earned it. So good for them.
All right, Dr. Lyle. Well, we've got a couple of questions today, and one of them, the first one is, says, Dr. Lyle, it's often said that a good way to make friends is to ask people for small favors because people will like others more if they've done favors for them. From the cognitive dissonance perspective, this makes perfect sense. But from the evolutionary perspective, it looks like exploitation. Is this actually a good way to initiate relationships?
This goes under the heading you just asking for a wider ranging answer here. There's nothing wrong with this little trick. It's not the worst thing in the world. It's also pretty small potatoes. It's got very, very small effect sizes. So what's going to happen very often in science is what you get published are things that are, particularly in psychology and social psychology, are things that are kind of cute and interesting. And so everybody's trying to look useful and creative. This is a minor league effect. I can't say that I've gone and checked the data on it. Just that I know, I already know, I don't even have to look, which is pretty arrogant, but I actually already know. The effect sizes on this are going to be very small. And they're going to be ephemeral, so it's no big deal. It's actually not the worst thing to do. If there's some girl you're interested in, you might just pull that stunt just to get a little interaction going, and that may be a way to essentially initiate a little bit of contact. But it's not going to be like, oh wow, her percentile rating of you just went up 6%. Not a chance. Okay. So this is sort of much ado about nothing by a bunch of social psychologists that don't have anything better to do. There.
So I actually was discussing this with a friend a couple weeks ago, and I guess this is called the Benjamin Franklin effect. It's a psychological phenomenon that supposedly if you ask someone to perform a favor, they're more likely to do another favor from you. And so we actually went down the rabbit hole of looking where exactly this came from. And it turns out Ben Franklin thought that this was an effect because he had some rival legislator in I forgot what state he was running for, but he decided that he was going to ask the guy to borrow a certain book. And after he got lent the book, then their friendship continued all the way through. And so we kind of looked to see what actually happened. It turns out that in writing him a letter requesting to borrow the book, Ben Franklin mm-hmm. was flooding the guy's circuits like you wouldn't believe. Like it was like
right.
such a smart person would have such a great book. And so I would love to just look at that book and gain the knowledge that you had. You know, I mean, it was really laid on thick. And so we postulated that, of course, the guy would want to be this guy's friend because he's going to want to tell everyone that he's got good judgment.
Right. There you go. That's good. That I can't believe you dug down through that. But, hey, good for you. Yeah. So, So meanwhile, social psychologists don't know the backstory. Somebody comes up with a study. Turns out there's a very small little effect size behind it. And somebody gets published. Good for them. But it's pretty close to about as trivial as you can get.
Mm-hmm. I guess we should ask people for small favors, but flood their circuits. Then we'll see.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. All right. Well, some more. What's that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, some more psychology, pop culture tricks. Dr. Lyle,
yeah.
In mainstream psychology, there's a lot of talk about burying feelings, not wanting to face feelings, and not wanting to be alone with one's thoughts, and hiding sadness behind anger, and so on and so forth. Is this true? Mm-hmm. For example, do some people really drink to forget? Do people refuse to acknowledge problems for reasons other than Stone Age status calculations, purely just to spare their own feelings?
Good, very good question here. And I'm going to back it up and say, we're going to take a look at the opening phrase of the question in mainstream psychology. We should say mainstream, uneducated, psychodynamic oriented pop psychology or even professional psychology among people who are not paying any attention to the scientific literature and aren't integrating their practice with anything that's ever been established in science. You won't find scientists talking about bearing feelings. It's just not in there. You won't hear cognitive psychologists talk about burying memories either. So this is not the mind's architecture. So you can do certain little things with your feelings. If you're under a lot of, you know, you're sort of flooded, your girlfriend just broke up with you. You can get yourself distracted for a period of time, which can bring you some relief. You can go play basketball, and for a couple hours there, you won't be thinking about it because you'll be fully engaged in some other process. And undoubtedly, you can change your mood state with drugs and get some temporary relief from a mood state that's very unpleasant. But but you're not going to bury the feelings, for God's sakes. You can forget about that. They're going to reemerge as soon as the distraction or the drug wears off. Instantaneously. In other words, they're going to be as soon as by taking yourself and going to go play. I know a guy that was going through a divorce. He went and played volleyball every night for like 6 weeks. And in doing so, he was giving himself a respite from all of the thinking that was going on in his head, because it's what we're going to call a flow activity. In other words, it's requiring full engagement of the mind. And so, but then as soon as it's over, you take a shower in no time, your mind is back working on the problem, because your mind is designed by nature to be grinding through the most important problems that it faces. But when you're out there with the team, the most important problem that you face is, how are we going to win? And so you're capturing the Stone Age problem there, and it's giving you full engagement. If you don't have something like that to do, then yeah, somebody may open a bottle of whiskey and essentially distract their mind's ability to compute anything and give themselves a buzz. And yeah, that gives them a little bit of relief, but not much. And so the notion of the thing being buried is ludicrous. It's not being buried by anything. It can be temporarily distracted. So let me think what else. Do people refuse to acknowledge problems? There is no refusal to acknowledge problems inside your own mind. Let me formulate this as best I can. it's kind of, I understand kind of where the Freudians were coming from when they talked about ego defenses. The reason why some of this makes sense, and if you read them from a slightly altered perspective, if you, instead of the word ego, substitute the word status and realize that people will do a lot of things in the name of status defense. So the notion of an alcoholic, quote, in denial, they aren't in denial to themselves, for God's sakes. They're in denial to everybody else. That's a status defense. The notion that somehow the mind can't handle its own pain and therefore it needs to hide from its own generated pain of its acknowledgement of its horrendous circumstances is ludicrous. Let me explain. This is where this psychodynamic kind of thinking essentially is unintegrated with biology, and therefore bad biology makes bad psychology. And this is actually a fundamental and key point to understand the difference between evolutionary psychology and other views in psychology, including dynamic views. Dynamic folks across history haven't been stupid at all. They've been subtle and often brilliant. But they did not, you know, a lot of their thinking has crashed on the rocks of greater analysis. And also what irritates me is the current practitioners, you know, aren't sort of up with the times, and they are very defensive about the status loss of psychoanalysis and psychodynamic thinking in the current age when we have turned the halogen light on the mistakes and nobody's interested in looking at it. And one of those things is the notion that the, quote, ego can't handle it, or the person can't handle it, therefore they're going to bury their feelings, repress their thoughts, etc. As if the mind has to hide from itself, okay? Let's point something out here. The purpose of the mind isn't to not be in pain. Someone was explaining to me, there's a notion that I've read at times and by various thinkers, and I almost didn't know what they were coming from, but somebody told me this is a Jungian, there's a thread of Jungian thinking in this, is the notion that if you, you know, don't keep your mind organized or something, it's going to fly out into chaos. This is, of course, ridiculous. Nothing of the kind is going to take place. The mind is organized relentlessly about your present and future survival and reproductive prospects. That is what the mind is for. That is its design. The heart's job isn't to keep your secret feelings. Your heart's job is to run your circulatory system. That's what it does, okay? Your lymph nodes do what they do. Your kidney does what your kidney does. Your big toe does what it does. And your mind does what it does. And if it turned out that, you know, if people had feelings of loss or feelings of overwhelm, they, quote, overwhelmed the system and it would go into some kind of terrible feelings that were overwhelming and therefore dysfunctional for the organism, then organisms with the characteristics where that could happen would not have evolved. The feelings that you have are calibrated in order to signal for you. It would be like, for example, if you had feelings of feeling hot, and so finally, if you were so hot that you couldn't stand it and you would go crazy because, you know, it was just too hot. No, that isn't what's going to happen. You're just going to suffer, okay? And you'll suffer and be miserable. Now, you may pass out, but you may pass out because that's a mechanical device for getting you flat and getting some other things that increases your likelihood of survival. That's not, you know, that isn't analogous to what people do with their feelings or their thoughts. So the notion that there's some reason why human beings can't handle their feelings and that they would repress them, that their internal process would, quote, refuse to acknowledge them or anything else under the sun, makes no sense in terms of biology and doesn't make any sense in terms of any observed processes in psychology. It's a story. And there's many, many fanciful stories like this. Like, for example, the story of great story. I may have said this great story that I read, you know, was from the mid-century America. It was a Random Harvest. They made a movie out of it. I think it was J.J. Hilton was the author. I believe that's correct. And beautiful story about a guy who, you know, is amnesiac, and his wife sticks with him for, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. And then one day it just all comes back to him. Okay. Not happening. Okay. That's not how that's going to work. Okay. I thought that that's how things could work. And there's been many stories in literature and many stories in the movies of that sort of thing happening. No, that's not how the mind works. That's not how memory function works. It doesn't have an on and off switch where it all stays together or all goes away. And there's no such thing as something was too painful and therefore I can't remember it. Not a chance. That is a super common thing in Hollywood. And why shouldn't it be? That's what their shrinks are telling them. As if this has any reality. It has no reality. That's not how the mind works. And however, people will, they will do some distractions to give them short-term relief. Just as there's short-term amnesia if you have a head injury, you can get short-term relief from your feelings if you get yourself fully engaged or alter the brain chemistry for a short period of time. But none of that stuff is going anywhere. Whatever's bothering you, the mind will instantly go back to working on those problems. And in fact, it's working on those problems silently, even when you're playing basketball.
And so when people say, Nate, you can't bottle up your feelings, otherwise it's going to come out later.
Oh, yeah.
Is that more psychology?
That's absolutely exactly. That's kissing cousin with everything we're just talking about. That is totally ludicrous. And the notion that if you, quote, bottle up your feelings, that it's going to come out in some kind of psychosomatic damage is, like, absolutely ludicrous. This is just fanciful stuff that goes on with people that don't know anything about the mind's architecture, how it works. I mean, it could have been true in theory. In other words, somewhere in an alternative universe, things could work that way. But they don't work that way in the universe that we live in. That's not how things work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when earlier in the show, earlier in the podcast, mm-hmm. a few episodes back, way back, you had said that agreeable people will sometimes mm-hmm. lash out when they've taken the mm-hmm. short end of the stick enough times, and then they just finally have had it. And it reminded me of the times when people say, oh, you don't bottle up your feelings, otherwise you're going to lash out and do that. It's actually
that's very good. Let's talk about that just for a point of clarity. What's happening is that the agreeable person, or even not so agreeable person, could be a not so agreeable person who is inhibiting the expression of their anger. Because what they have, the mind has competing agendas. And one of the agendas is, I'm not in a position of power with this individual. And therefore, I'm being exploited here, but I have to just take it. Okay. That's my best negotiating position. And so the organism is under tension because it feels like things are unfair. And so it wants to speak up, but it's actually not in its best interest. Okay. Now, then we have successive iterations of the same kind of situation with the same individual. And we feel like that they are drawing the line again in their favor at our expense. And it's all, you know, it's once again, it's not fair. And now what's happening is we have sent little signals, quiet little signals, non-heavy agreement signals. We don't laugh at what it is that they're saying. We send little bitty signals telling them that we don't feel like it's that fair. But it doesn't do anything. They exploit us anyway. And once again, from our relative position of weakness, we actually choke it down again. And then it happens again, and then it happens again, and then it happens again. Now, at this point, the psychodynamic shrink comes along and says, or social worker, psychologist comes along and says, Oh, you're bottling up your feelings. They're going to explode. Okay? You're not bottling up anything. You're running a cost-benefit analysis that is strategic in terms of trying to figure out how to get your best interests served in terms of survival and reproductive success. That's what you're doing. Now, what you may do is you may there may be a moment where you feel like, okay, the cost benefit, now we've gone over the line. If this continues, it looks like this exploitation is going to continue indefinitely. So what I'm going to need to do is I already feel like I've sent 42 silent signals that this is out of line, and they have disregarded those signals. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to blow up. Okay. So what the blowing up is it's actually a huge wake-up call to the person on the other side. The reason why it's going to be a blow-up, it's not going to be a slight little snivel of disagreement. It's going to be actually a signal that I'm about ready to walk. Okay? I know I'm in a position of weakness in this relationship. Otherwise, I would have been speaking up a long time ago about having been exploited. And what I've been doing is, as the exploitation has continued, I have been contemplating how it is that I can survive without this relationship. And so every time I send you a little signal and you blow right past it, like ignoring a stop sign, and you keep doing this, I am getting closer and closer to the realization is that this exploitation is going to continue indefinitely. And I'm now running the CB on whether or not I even want to be in the relationship. And what I'm now going to do is I'm now going to put all my cards on the table, and you won't know if I'm bluffing or not. Because with my anger at a high enough pitch, I am going to explode. And basically what I'm going to tell you is we have to renegotiate, and it's going to go my direction a hell of a long ways from where it is right now. Because you've been totally unfair. This kind of explosive anger is an attempt to recalibrate the person on the other side of this negotiation and to cause them to feel guilt. If they feel guilt, then they're likely to concede, and now everything can settle down and the relationship can continue. Okay? If, however, you can see how this would go. It's quite possible that the person on the other side will say, screw you, pipsqueak. I'm in a position of power here, and I am not out of line, and you're going to have to choke it down and deal with it. Well, our person who's exploded has essentially come very close to crossing the Rubicon. The only reason they gave this signal is because they have computed that they're just about out of this relationship unless it gets renegotiated. Okay, so that's what it is. You didn't bottle up your feelings. Your feelings are strategic, and your mind is working brilliantly to try to figure out what's in your best interest. And if you have a reasonably well configured nervous system, when you explode, there's usually a hell of a good reason, and there's a good reason we explode then as opposed to some other time. And we didn't. This is not some out of control organism. This is a deeply brilliant manipulative organism with trillions of dendritic connections computing what's in the organism's best interest. At that moment, it may win or it may lose, but there's a reason why it did what it did. And it wasn't for some pop psych reason that, quote, you suppressed your feelings and then they blew up. Not a chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating because that whole bottle up explanation really interests me because I've heard from many people that have to learn how to express yourself before that happened, and you have to learn how to this and that. It's just, it's interesting because the agreeable people that I've met who have, quote, bottled it up and they explode.
Yeah.
What happens is exactly what you just described. And when they express to me their frustration, these are some patients of mine that I've talked to. When they express to me that, this person's psychologist says they have to learn how to catch it before it starts. And they say, they say it's bullshit. Yeah.
You're not going to catch it before it starts. You're running a strategy. Okay. Now, probably the way around this, you know, can you do better than your genetic code at this? Probably. So let me tell you one way to do better than the genetic code at things like this. That if you're not starving and you're not hungry, and you don't have hungry little children with wiggly teeth that need fixed by the dentist, then you probably are reasonably comfortable. And when you're reasonably comfortable, you're not in a crisis. And when you're not in a crisis, you just as soon not have a bunch of upheaval and troubles and have to like hustle around and change things in your life. Just energy conservation says, hey, it's not too bad the way it is. So behind this, we are very, it's not uncommon, particularly for agreeable people, to be choking down some relationships in their life that are exploitative. Now, exploitative, I don't mean like Karl Marx and, you know, we're dealing with, you know, 1793 and the French Revolution exploitative. I'm talking about, you know, something is like 65-35 the other person's direction, and they're, for some reason, they're in a position of power in the relationship, and they're exploiting that, and you're in a position of weakness, and so you're kind of getting the short straw a lot. That's what I'm talking about. And along the way, what's happening is that your anger, anger and frustration are starting to bubble up and get a little bit more intense from time to time. And there starts to be little tiny cues that we leak to the other individuals that we're not that happy and that we think that this is unfair. So we start leaking that. It doesn't never the case that people are pleasant, and then explode. That isn't what happens. They are pleasant people and they leak. Okay, so they leak their frustrations very freaking quietly, often passive aggressively. In other words, they don't actually do anything for a negative signal. It's what they don't do for the positive signals that is the very quiet way of telling the exploitative partner in a trade that this is not right. Okay, so the where was I? I'm lost.
You were talking about how to get out of how to beat your genes with regards to bottling up. Yeah.
Thank good somebody's paying attention. So no, the thing is that very often people in these relationships can sit right there like a dog laying on a nail and don't do what it takes to get out of it. And so a lot of times what it takes to get out of it is work harder, reduce your expenditures, find out, you know, get competent to leave that firm, get competent financially and socially to leave that marriage, to leave that friendship, to leave that parent-child relationship and alter its character substantially if needed. In other words, what you need to get to is a position of power. And a position of power is that if things don't, you know, go the way that you would like them to go, then you're fine. You're fine with the alternative pathway. That's a position of power. So that's how you stop exploitation. Exploitation ends where a position of power begins. Because a position of power is the concept that whatever it is that you want, you can live without it. Okay, whatever it is you want out of this relationship, you figured out how you can live without it. You don't need the job. You don't need the marriage. You don't need the goodwill of your adult children so that you can see your grandchildren. You don't need the goodwill of your parents for this or that or other reason. You know, you're not feeling beholden to that relationship. That relationship only need exist if it turns out that it's joyful, pleasant, you know, et cetera, supportive, that it's a good relationship. When it's an exploitative relationship and you're quietly choking down your frustration, the reason you're quietly choking it down, headed to a blow up, is because you're in a position of weakness. Okay? You've not yet figured out how it is that you're going to live without it, and you haven't made peace with that. And so that's, I see many people in positions of weakness that could be cured by some hustle and some courage. And then they don't have to put up with the exploitations that they're putting up with. And so that's the fundamental assertiveness training strategy, is not to, you know, express your feelings earlier in the dynamic, et cetera. No, it isn't expressing your feelings, because the jerk on the other side isn't interested anyway. If they're in an exploitive pattern and they're not reading your subtle cues, what makes you think they're going to renegotiate the situation if your cues get to be more open and direct? Not likely. Okay. So instead, put yourself in a position of power before you renegotiate. And then when you renegotiate, you renegotiate from a position of strength, not weakness. It's like, hey, listen, this is what it is that I think I'm worth, and this is the raise that I'm seeking. Well, I don't think so, Chief. That's not what I'm going to do. Fine. Okay. That's what I needed to know. All right. Then you ask for that raise because you know you've got alternatives, or you have a high probability that you've got alternatives that you could get. And a raise could be a placeholder for anything. For I have this amazing thing that I see happen. I see people complaining quite bitterly and in frustration and in hurt over the fact that their spouses just don't show them the respect and the love and the affection that they want. And I look at this and I look at it in some degree in amazement. It's like, there's really nothing to be done about this. That's not their fault. If they don't feel those things toward you, that's just the way it is. Okay. So your job is to get yourself in a position of power where you understand that you don't have to have those things. You can live without it. Okay. How are you going to now make your life fine, you know, assuming that you're not going to get those things? What are you going to do? Are you going to stay in the relationship for the other values that it affords, or are you going to leave? Okay. So that this is the notion, rather than, you know, being chronically frustrated with the fact that somebody else isn't giving us something what we want. The job is to just, hey, terminate the search inside that other person's nervous system and move on. This is the, explained not with the terminology of positions of power, but this is explained by Harry Brown in How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. And this is what he calls the difference between a direct and an indirect alternative. And this is a very important principle of just, you know, essentially the search for happiness. And that is that if you are attempting to, if someone else has to do something and they have to change in order for you to be happy, you are working on an indirect alternative. If you can just make a change and it doesn't matter what it is that they do, then you're working on a direct alternative. Direct alternatives are way better than indirect alternatives. Okay, so whenever you catch yourself in a frustrating situation, like, for example, somebody frustrated that their spouse isn't giving them the love and affection and support or whatever else it is that they feel like that they want and that they feel like somehow they're entitled to, that what they're working on is an indirect alternative. The direct alternative is to look at the situation and say, hey, if those are the things that I seek, it looks like I'm going to need to seek them elsewhere. Okay. And sometimes there needs to be frank discussion or a frank realization that that's what needs to happen. So if you've got a boss that doesn't seem to appreciate your work and doesn't, you know, isn't paying you what it is that you think that you're worth, go calibrate and find out. Find out what your options are. And then if you think that those options are legitimate, but you can't afford to be out of work for 6 days, then you're not in a position of power yet. But if you figured out how you could finance a period of time that you needed to make a transition, or better yet, just go get another job offer, okay, and then leave. Or with that job offer in hand, renegotiate. Okay, so or attempt to renegotiate first, get shut down, and then go get a job offer and leave. So there's sequences of operations here. You know, there's some flexibility with what how it is to handle this. But the main message is that when people are, quote, bottling up their feelings, all you're really seeing is a frustrated person who has not yet reached a position of power and isn't ready to try a renegotiation tactic. When they lose their cool, they're losing their cool because they've come to a point where they feel like they need to renegotiate this deal because it's so lousy and they're so frustrated that they're willing to blow the whole thing up. Now, are they right or wrong? Answer, well, let's find out how much intelligence, conscientiousness, and emotional stability they have. If they have all three of those things in decent quantities, then their computation is probably accurate. Okay? If it turns out that they don't, then their computation is probably inaccurate. And what we're just looking at is a wing nut who's just gone off because they've got a misguided view of what their value is in a relationship, and they feel like they've been exploited, but they really weren't. Okay, fine. They're going to find out that the world's, you know, they're going to get recalibrated the hard way. That's okay. That's the price of being dealt those genetic cards, you know, at conception. But most people, most of the nice people who are pretty conscientious that are getting exploited, yeah, you're, quote, sitting on your feelings because those feelings are slowly, the computations that are driving those are slowly driving you towards increased signaling of dissatisfaction, and it will be subtle or dramatic depending upon the positions of power that you wind up achieving through the preparations or mental work that you need in order to achieve that.
Absolutely fascinating. So yeah, this it's really interesting that what you just said, because I have friends who have YouTube channels and they're always on social media. And when we talk and catch up, a couple of times they say that it really stresses them out that that people write and respond to their videos with all kinds of harsh things, and it really does. Like I've made posts before, yeah. And I've, you know, I have a business that has a, you know, that had a Yelp page and all these other things, and so it does stress you out when things don't go the way you expected.
Right.
And just recently, somebody asked Dr. Jen Hauck, who you talked about last week.
Mm-hmm.
Why she doesn't enable YouTube comments on her YouTube channel. And her response was brilliant.
Yeah.
She said it doesn't match up. You know, there's no need for random people. I can read it. There's no need to do that. Not supportive of a happiness environment. So on one end, she decided to turn off the comment section, not deal with the whole thing. I think that was really smart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the first of 17,000 smart things you're going to hear Jen Hauck say.
really
exactly. exactly. This is a bizarre environment you live in now. That if you're sort of semi-public and you've got, I don't know, Facebook page or, you know, Instagram or whatever these things are, and people can be commenting on what you look like, what you said, whether they disagree with you, etc. Keep in mind that most of the time, anybody that's troubling to listen to you, 90%+ of those people like you and they are supportive. And so if they ever say anything, it's great. You would like to see that because it's beautiful, positive feedback. It's dinging your pseudo esteem seeking chip. So it's like, hey, they don't really know me that well and I don't know them, but I'm getting an esteem cue. And it seems to be for about the right reasons, so it's pretty good. Now, the problem is, in the same said communication environment, we have 10% of the people who are shitheads. It's just how they are. They're born that way, folks. They can't help themselves. It's not their fault. We can't correct them. If we snarl at them and get angry and tell them they're unfair, they're just going to look at us like, what are you talking about? I'm totally reasonable. They can't help it. Somebody has to be at the 90th+ percentile for disagreeable. And so it's no surprise. I mean, they just are. So those people exist, and it isn't that they had a bad childhood, and it isn't that they're just going through a tough time. they're just a shithead. They can't help it. You know, I have obviously more negative feelings towards these people than I do towards people in the bottom 10 percentile for intelligence. The bottom 10 percentile for people in intelligence, you have many sort of negative names for them, pejorative names for them. But you know what? I have no such feelings negative for these people, other than they can occasionally frustrate you when they do something that's inconveniencing you, and then you don't realize until you talk to them for a couple seconds that they did the best they could. Okay, and it's like, oh, I see. That's what we're dealing with there. Well, you know what? You thank God that they've got a nice little life in a nice free country that's pretty well-to-do, so that they're not starving because they're pretty incompetent. Okay, so that's fine. So we don't have particularly negative feelings about people like that. We try to help them. But in another dimension, and you know, 90th percentile introvert, it's like, hey, they're not bothering anybody. They're just giving you a quiet, they're moving away from you in the library when you're in there whispering to your friend because you're causing too much noise. Okay, so however, disagreeable people are the cause of the vast majority of problems in civilization. They're the cause of almost all of the litigation. They're the cause of almost all the criminal activity. It's like they're just nothing but trouble. Now, there's a use for them. So if they're really smart and conscientious, they make good lawyers. Fine. God knows you don't want to hang out with them, but if you need to hire one of them, they're useful. But the point is that when they're on your social media page and they're making comments about you that are negative, for God's sakes, that they can't help themselves. It's like the little guy at the restaurant that can't make you change, you know, $10 minus $5. It's the same kind of thing. Like that's just what you're dealing with. They can't help it. They're just disagreeable. And it's annoying as all get out. And we would like to recalibrate them and make them civil, but you can't. It's genetic. So my advice is to anybody, like, I've never looked at feedback on any of my stuff. Never happened. Probably not going to. I mean, it's been out there for a number of years. I've had different feedback. Sometimes people send me feedback, but I'll tell you what, when people write to me and they give me feedback, that's pleasant, because now these people are jumping over some hoops and they're going to write to me and they're going to say, hey, I really like this, I really like that, thanks for putting your stuff out there. Great. You know, I've almost never received a negative in email. I've about three people in 10 years have sent me argumentative emails. And, you know, I think you know one of them, Nathan. From a few years ago. Yeah, in a foreign country, we have some character that fancies himself a genius and needs to explain to us how we're all wrong. So they show themselves, and then they get deleted. Okay, beautiful, gone. So yeah, this is what we try to do is surround the input. You're kind of a piano, and the music that's played on that piano, what it sounds like, that's your emotional life. And what counts as to what that's going to sound like is what energetic inputs hit the piano keyboard. The piano is your nervous system. It has, just like the sounds of the piano, the tones and the chords and what these things could sound like in combination, those are the feelings of your existence. They represent, and the way the piano is set up, the feelings represent, just as the piano tones are mathematically interrelated to each other in an exacting way, so are your feelings exactingly related to each other, and they're related to the underlying computations of values that the machine computes according to Stone Age algorithms inherited, you know, into your DNA. So the sound of your particular piano, i.e. the emotional tone of your existence, is going to be the result of the energies that hit the piano keys. that is your environment. The piano and its configuration, how it works, that's your genetic structure. That's you. Your environment sits outside of that. And, you know, somebody comes along, you know, a cat jumps on the piano and, you know, causes a, you know, lousy sound. That's like something unpleasant happened in your environment that wasn't supposed to happen that way. Not a good thing. So you get, you can also have sad sounds when things happen and happy sounds, et cetera. Our job is to try to have happy, positive interactions with other people in the world, that is the energy that hits the circuits. And then that creates the moods of happiness. So what Dr. Hawk was saying is, for goodness sakes, don't leave yourself open to a bunch of critics that we know are out there because they can't help themselves because it's in their genes. And so they're going to squawk and complain and criticize, et cetera. And if you're a conscientious individual who would be understandably be looking for feedback from your work, the problem is you'll get 9 positives and then you'll get 1 nasty negative. And that's a bad thing in a Stone Age village. You could have 18 people saying good things about you, but if you have 2 people saying really bad things about you, that's an insecure situation and that's going to be unpleasant. You're going to have to keep your eye on it and you're going to try to sequester them and you're going to try to essentially deactivate their political power, et cetera. You're in a war with somebody in that village that's after to undermine your status. So when you read these things, if you're a producer of anything that the world is responding to, that if you read those things, your mind is going to get busy about what it is that they're saying, what you know, how you're supposed to fix it, how you're supposed to neutralize them, et cetera. What a tremendous waste of time and energy. Much better move. Don't bother. Okay. Do what you do. Let the world do whatever it does with it and ignore it. That's people will find a way that like you. They'll find a way to get to you if they want to and say positive things. And then your world is surrounded by beautiful music. And that's what we want.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lau, one last one for tonight. It has to do with these types of comments. So probably exactly the same vein. Dr. Lyle, I'm not easily appalled, but the internet got me when I read about a porn star recently committing suicide. And some top comments on this internet articles were along the lines of, quote, nothing of value was lost, etc. This isn't the first time I heard something like this. Who would have this lack of empathy towards sex workers, and how common do you think it is? Do you think it comes from, quote, slut shaming? I also recall that from the blank slate that when people feel something like disgust, I'm assuming from potential STDs and paternal uncertainty in this case, they tend to blindly craft morals from it.
Yeah, this is sophisticated thinking. Anybody that read the blank slate, for God's sakes, got a big IQ. I'd have to think through some of what it is that they're saying there, and I don't want to give a quick and dirty answer. Obviously, I think they've hit the nail on the head there that if we have disgust reactions towards other people for various reasons, there could be many people that would be offended by people that do porn work, and it could potentially threaten them in various and sundry ways, and so therefore the implication would be that those people have essentially been costly to me. And therefore, if one of them dies, all is, that's good. That's a good thing for me. That's if I'm in a war with the Russians and I hear that some Russian got sick and died, that's a good thing for me. Okay. So that's why, obviously people's reactions are emanating from Stone Age algorithms as they run cost-benefit analysis on what it is that they see. And so anybody that would have that reaction, my reaction about anybody dying pretty much is pretty neutral because most of it doesn't have anything to do with me. If it has anything even remotely to do with me, it's going to be, it's generally in all most ways, it's going to be negative. There would be people in principle that I might feel some significant conflicts with. I don't know who they are, but if I found out that they died, I don't know that I would wish an untimely death on anybody, because then that makes me feel like, you know, that just reminds me of the capriciousness of existence and that it could happen to me. But if it turns out that some old nemesis that I couldn't stand, that's, you know, 25 years older than I am, and I couldn't stand the person, I felt like they didn't have any integrity and that they undermined the pursuit of knowledge and honest helping of other people to serve their own interests. And that's what I feel like they did with their life. And if they die, I get some satisfaction out of it. So that's I'm no saint there. So this is why this is this way. And I think that's why, similarly, somebody that would feel like their best interests are threatened by the fact that some people choose to do porn for a living, those individuals could have a decided, not just lack of empathy, but actually and essentially a satisfied aggression in feeling like one of the bad, evil people on the other side, you know, was lost, and that's a gain for the good guys. So I think that that's why that happens that way.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.